There are 39 milahot, which constitute forms of work forbidden on the Sabbath. It's the why behind the way we do the things we do. Join Rabbi Moshe Schnurb now for Hilchos Shabbos, only on 101.9 High FM.
This is Soul to Soul on your radio. Erev Shabbos Kodesh, Parshas Pinchas, Tov Shin Pei Hey. As we begin, Baruch Hashem, another time of being able to spend together, of being able to be mechazik ourselves, be able to hopefully learn something new, be inspired, get ourselves ready for another intense and beautiful, beautiful Shabbos Kodesh. Habolenu L'Toiva, and a very, very warm welcome to all of our radio family. Thank you so, so much for joining us. Thank you so much for wanting to be part of our Torah, for wanting, Be'ez Hashem, the fact that you've turned your radio on shows that you're a person that's a mavakesh, that wants to learn, that wants to grow, that wants to hear, that wants to somehow make this Shabbos something very, very unique. As always, the program is sponsored as a refuah shlema for some of the cholim in our area, Elio Yechinan ben Shena Tena, Abizev Yankov ben Liora, Shimon Leib ben Ahuva Batsheva, Zalman Yitzchok ben Fege Rivka, Aviva Sharon bas Mina Shena, Gila bas Miriam, Nechama bas Rochel, Yet Yena Bas Alexandra B'Soich Shor Chole Yisrael. May all those here or abroad, anywhere in the world, anywhere, all of Achenu Ben Yisrael who need any kind of refuah, any kind of yeshuas, any kind of kiss from the Rabbeinu Shalom to help them in whatever predicament they find themselves. May they be benched. May they be blessed. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu shine His countenance on them and give them exactly what they need. Parshas Pinchas. Beginning the Pasha, Pinchas is given a special, special reward for what he did at the end of last week's Pasha in sort of eliminating what they call today neutralizing forces, people that were doing things that were clearly a huge Chilul Hashem and Nasi of Klal Yisrael, who had violated in the most terrible, terrible way and had cavorted with a Midianite princess. Lochein emor, therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, say, hineni noisen lo yesperisi shalom. Behold, I'm giving him my covenant of peace. Pinchas saw an outrageous act of sort of moral turpitude and took very decisive action, meeting out the ultimate punishment to the two perpetrators. He was rewarded with the kahuna, priesthood, the covenant of peace. Until that time, there were only three kohanim in the world, and he was not destined to be a kohen, and yet he became one. Upon taking a closer look at the rewards, a sort of striking contrast is evident between Pinchas' response to the sin and the reward that he received. To act so zealously, risking one's life, demands a strong element of the midah, the attribute of gevura, of strength, discipline, strict judgment. The reward of a bris shalom, of covenant of peace, is reflective of the midah of chesed, of kindness. Why would an act of zealousness be rewarded with peace? How does gevura sort of align with chesed? Simply, true peace can only be achieved once evil is sort of removed from the world. If it's sort of uncontrolled, unchecked, then corruption spreads, causing even greater and greater harm. By acting decisively, Pinchas restored harmony to Klal Yisrael. This explains how Gevura is used to achieve Chesed. The Nesivos Shalom explains that actually Pinchas' zealotry was an act of Chesed, not gevura. Right? It says, Vayar Pinchas. Pinchas saw, right, the degradation and kind of utter humiliation of the Jewish people. Zimri's public violation of the moral code disgraced not only himself, but all of Klal Yisrael as well. Our people are an Am Kodesh, a holy nation. And when we display such an act of defilement publicly, right, it really ruins our Kedusha. Pinchas could not tolerate the shame that was sort of heaped upon Klal Yisrael. So he risked his life to stop the blatant Chilul Hashem, the disgrace of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's name. By doing so, he was able to revitalize Klal Yisrael's esteem. We'll take a break now and come back with much, much more. This is 101.9 Chai FM. The program is Soul to Soul. Please stay with us. We're only just starting.
There are 39 milahot which constitute forms of work forbidden on the Sabbath. It's the why behind the way we do the things we do. Join Rabbi Moshe Schnurb now for Hilchos Shabbos, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
Chai FM, soul to soul, back on your radio. Erev Shabbos Kodesh, Parshas Pinchas, Tov Shin Pei Hei, the first of the Shabbosas of the 3 weeks of mourning between Shavuos Tammuz and Tishah B'Av. We're learning this week about Parshas Pinchas, and we started in the last segment with the same pasuk. We'll start again. L'chein emor, therefore say. I'm going to give Pinchas the covenant of peace. Now, we spoke before about the concept of taking a stand. And of course, times taking a stand for what is the right thing requires incredibly enormous courage. Right? Taking a stand, acting boldly to sort of uphold the will of Hashem requires that one be an authentic Yirei Shemayim, a God-fearing Jew. Many sort of talk the talk, but when the situation demands that he actually walk the walk, his feet suddenly begin to hurt. Two individuals, right? Tzelofchad's daughters were actually, five of them, Pinchas and the B'nai Tzelofchad, went against the prevailing spiritual current and either took decisive action or spoke up when, in fact, it was not really the popular thing to do. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu rewarded both of them. Right? Why did they do that? Because it was the will of Hashem, was the Ratzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Let's sort of go a little into their actions so that they can inspire and hopefully impact our lives, allowing for us to be more cognizant of the Ratzon of Hashem and to serve, right? Let that be our sort of North Star in navigating the peaks and valleys of life. Our guiding question should be, whenever a situation comes up and you have to make a decision, what does Hashem want me to do? B'nai Yisrael camped at Shittim. Sadly, it was a place in which the pagan nations were able to lead them to inappropriate behavior, including idolatry with the Midianite women. And this moral lapse led to a punishment, a severe, severe plague that decimated the guilty participants. Zimri ben Salu, the Nasi of the tribe of Shimon, sought to make a point. He took Cusbi, a Moabite princess, and publicly committed a despicable immoral act. that you dared Moshe Rabbeinu to do something about it. Incidentally, during our history, one sort of despot has always existed who cannot tolerate the influence the Gedolim, the great righteous Torah leaders, have over the nation. They attribute their control to sort of personal ambition, when in fact, the Torah leaders are only following HaKadosh Baruch Hu's directive. The influence is the Torah. Pinchas saw the outrage and took decisive action, right? Killing them both. His act of zealotry put a halt to the plague. The message was clear. Moshe was the leader of the Jewish people, right? Handpicked by HaKadosh Baruch himself. Pinchas displayed his unwavering commitment, putting his life and reputation in danger. Because, after all, it was the Ratzon Hashem, was a divine will, and that trumps all personal interests. The Bnei Tzelafchad, the five daughters of Tzelafchad, faced the prospect of their father's name and legacy being lost, as he had no sons. Halacha favors male descendants, right? Demonstrating remarkable courage and faith, they approached Moshe, requesting their deceased father's portion in the Holy Land. Moshe brought their case to Hashem, who responded affirmatively, stating that their claim was just, thereby establishing a precedent that daughters would inherit when the father had no sons. The Netziv explains that the timing of their request is crucial to understanding the psak, the halachic ruling. It followed the slanderous reports of the Meraglim, the spies, who, although punished for their sort of insidious speech, nevertheless left a negative taste for the nation to absorb. They were led to believe that Eretz Yisrael was a land that devours its inhabitants and whose present dwellers were a strong, unconquerable nation. Both narratives exemplify individuals who, guided by their faith and understanding of the Ratzon Hashem, acted decisively despite personal risk and being contrary to societal norms. Pinchas' zealotry and Bnei Tzelafchad's advocacy highlight the significance of standing up for what is right. For according to the Torah, it is right and just. Thus, both Pinchas and Bnei Tzelafchad turned to Moshe for guidance. We must act in alignment with divine principles, even if it is not popular in the environment that surrounds us. Rav Yechiel Toker Shlita tells a story of a very sort of popular Magid Shir, a lecturer in a yeshiva, who under no circumstances allowed his students to leave in the middle of Seder, in the middle of the study session. As far as he was concerned, everything could wait. The post office, the dentist, the doctor's appointments, parents, everyone could wait until after Seder. And they had better return on time. This was an affable Rebbe who was easy to get along with, right? Highly respected and admired. But with regard to Torah study, he accepted no compromise, offered no flexibility whatsoever. At the end of the yeshiva year, the Bochrim all came to say goodbye and receive the Rebbe's warm blessing for a restful, productive summer Ben Hazmanim holiday. One thing gnawed at them. Their Rebbe was a very easy person who had many, many friends and was loved by his students. Why was he so impossibly inflexible with regard to Seder? He explains with the following story. Said, I was once a single bacher in yeshiva. Says, I was considered a top student and was blessed to find my Baruch Hashem, my heavenly designated partner, what they call Beshert, in no time. My father and future father-in-law took it upon themselves to purchase a flat for us at a reasonable price, right? One to which they were both in agreement. As the date of our wedding approached, and still no apartment had sort of appeared, so I decided to take things into my own hands. I decided to close my Gemara, take off time from yeshiva, and go flat hunting. I met a real estate broker who showed me an apartment that fit our criteria exactly. I said I would speak with my future father-in-law. When I described the apartment to him, so my father-in-law said that he had seen a for sale sign for this flat on the shul's bulletin board. So we proceeded to the seller and made the deal. It was then that the agent became livid, claiming that he had shown me the apartment first and as such deserved his customary commission as a broker. I replied that I had taken the flat because my father-in-law had seen the sign and shul. It made no difference. This man was bent on extracting his fee from me. He took me to court where I was obligated to pay him 25,000 shekel, which was a considerable amount of money. As a result, we were compelled to cut back on the furniture and appliances that were important to us. We had just lost a considerable amount of money because I had closed my Gemara one day to go looking for flats. The story is not yet over. There is more. After this fiasco, I made a firm decision to prioritize my Torah learning, and that under no circumstances would I take a break or close my Gemara to sort of buy any sort of mundane objective that was not life-threatening. Torah was paramount. We'll finish the story in the next post. This is 101.9 Chai FM, the program Soul to Soul. We're coming right back.
There are 39 milahot which constitute forms of work forbidden on the Sabbath. It's the why behind the way we do the things we do. Join Rabbi Moshe Schnurb now for Hilchos Shabbos, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is Soul to Soul. Back on your radio, Erev Shabbos Kodesh, Parshas Pinchas, Tav Shin Peye. So we're talking about this young Shiva man who lost 25,000 shekel because he closed his Gemara. But the story is not yet over. Right, we said he made the decision never to close his Gemara again. 10 years passed, and I was approached by a friend whom I knew from my early days at the yeshiva. He had an investment for me to consider, right? I was interested. After all, before I would realize it, my children would grow up as Hashem, and weddings and flats and kollel support would also become a way of life. So we know that a lecturer's, a magid shir's salary could not really compensate for such expenses. Apparently, the city of Ashkelon was selling parcels of land. His goal was to put together a Torah-oriented sort of neighborhood there. His strategy was to purchase the land at bargain basement sort of prices, and within a year, the price of the real estate would double. That was one of these, you sort of, you have nothing to lose and all to gain. Too good to be true ventures. He needed $25,000, four times the amount of shkalim, which I had lost 10 years earlier. I explained that I did not carry that sum in my pocket. I would have to make a loan from the bank, right, where my credit was good. I added that now is the time for second Seder in the Kollel, where I learned I could go to the bank only during Ben Hazman, only between sessions. The bank's hours did not coincide with my schedule. They were open, right, only in the Ben Hazmanim once a week on Wednesday. And today is Sunday. So please God, on Wednesday, I'll go and organize the loan. That Wednesday, as I prepared to go to the bank, my young son fell, requiring a trip to the doctor and stitches. By the time I returned, I barely made it to Seder on time. I had missed the bank. Needless to say, my friend was beside himself. We had no alternative but to wait until the following week. The following week, I went to the bank, took out a loan, and immediately went to my friend's home to share the good news. By now, you can imagine what happened. Right? The entire deal from beginning to end was a sham. The workings of a disreputable real estate broker who made away with the life savings of many, many an unsuspecting investor, of which my friend was one. Apparently, he was so taken in by the broker that he had convinced his parents, many family members and friends, who all lost every penny they had invested. His friend was afraid to leave his flat for fear of what the investors he had convinced would do to him. The Magid Shir looked at his Talmidim for a few moments, allowing the story to sink in. He then said, "When I closed my Gemara the first time, I lost 25,000 shekelim. When I refused to close it and refrained from taking time off Seder, I saved $25,000. Now you know why I will not compromise on Torah study, mine or yours." But let's deal with the subject we actually mentioned in this passing story of the daughters of Tzilachan. It seems interesting why it was that they got such a yearning for the land of Israel. They really wanted to go. While it doesn't seem the men were so hepped up about going. So it says that there wasn't a single person from the original counting of the Jewish nation by Moshe and Aaron who were around after the 40 years at the end when the Jews were about to go into the land of Israel, right? And then straight away, right, Torah says that, and then straight away the daughters of Tzlofchad come forward with their requests. Rashi brings down in Pasuk Samach Dalet, what does it mean, Uva Eila Hayish, says, but on the women, there was never a decree. And there was the incident of the spies brought about the death of the entire male generation from 20 to 60, but not for the women, because they loved Eretz Yisrael. The men were saying, "Nitna roish v'nashuv Mitzrayim, let's appoint a new leader and go back to Egypt." And the women were saying, "Tino lanu achuza, we want a piece of Eretz Yisrael." And that's why the connection of Benoit Slavkot to this verse in the Torah telling us that no males from the previous generation would go to the land of Israel. Comes the Kli Yakar and explains, why was it that the women of the Jewish nation chose and wanted to go into Eretz Yisrael, while the men didn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael? And he gives two reasons. He says as follows. Number one, Be'elohayish, there wasn't a single man, but the women, there were, because there was no gezeira, there was no decree against the women because of the sin of the Meragim. Only the men, because the men hated the land. These are his language. Sinim, they hated the land. And they said, let's go back to Mitzrayim. But the women loved the land. And that's why, as we see, as evidenced by the Benois Tzalavchot. And therefore, I want to give two reasons, he says. Number one, because we know there are certain lands where the very nature of the people that grow there are very modest, very circumspect. And then you have certain countries where the people that develop there are very immoral, very loud, very, very, very sort of brash. And Achazal say in the Medrash Rabbah that Shittim, this land of Shittim, was a place that developed all sorts of very, very decrepit and immoral people. And therefore, the Jewish men committed acts of immorality in Shittim because the whole neighborhood in that place, the atmosphere of that place, caused them to want to do immoral acts. Eretz Yisrael has a school, has a special, special quality that the land does not put up with immorality. As it in fact says in Sefer Vayikra, see, it's called because all these disgusting things that the people who lived there before you did, and they defiled the land of Israel. And he continues that he says, I've already written before that the men were unfortunately a little bit lax in their morality, and therefore they hated the land because the land hates immorality. But the women, who were beautiful women, who were discreet women, and they were complete in their faith of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? And even this Shalomis ben Divri can prove that the public, the pasuk publicizes about her, right? She was the only woman who ever was immoral amongst the entirety of the population of the Jewish women. And therefore, they loved Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael was a place made just for them, because Eretz Yisrael develops people who have this innate sense of tzniut. And you should know this is the case, because even this place called Shittim, where we're developed, where there's such an immoral atmosphere there, right? It was able to receive a healing remedy from Eretz Yisrael, because the Navi Yoel says there, Umein Yot Umayan Yot Sami Beis Hashem, a well will come out from the Beis Hamikdash, the Hishka Esnachal Hashitim, and even then the Beis Hamikdash will have a positive influence even on Shittim. And for this reason, it says, there were no men left. But it says specifically that only there were no men left, but the women there were. Because when the Jewish nation was counted in this week's Parsha, they were, who was left? The Tzinuim, the modest women. And that's the first reason the Kli Yakar brings. He then gives a second reason to explain the difference between the distinction between men and women. He says the second reason is because it's well known that there's a very, very big distinction between Eretz Yisrael and all other countries. Because in Eretz Yisrael, the rain is much more prevalent than, let's say, in Egypt or the other areas around that. Now, in Egypt, because there's no rain coming, so therefore they need, the farmers need actually to create their own irrigation, let's say of their fields and stuff like that, with their own efforts, right? In other words, they have to make canals from the Nile, and since They have so much difficulty, so much bother in working their fields. The Torah exempted them from having to separate Truma and Maisa, the tithes, because they have to put so much effort into their field, because it's not fair that, because after all the effort, they should still have to give away part of what they gave to someone who actually didn't work at all. But on Eretz Yisrael, where the rain comes down in its right time, and the people who owns the field don't have to work that hard in irrigating their fields, and even though, yes, of course, he has to still plant the field, and he still has to plow the field, and all the other different activities that are needed in the field, nevertheless, there's HaKadosh Baruch Hu who also has a very, very great portion to play in the field, because Hashem gives the rain in its correct time. And therefore, it makes sense that they should have to give something back, so to speak, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu's earthly representatives, which are the Kohanim and the Levim, the ones who serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu all the time, because they actually get it, what we call Mishulchan Gavoya, from the table of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, for this reason, the men actually did not like Eretz Yisrael, because they were sort of they were people who were a little bit stingy, a little far away from giving tzedakah, and they had no desire or want to go to a place, right, where until now they had no obligation to separate tithes, to go to a land where they were obligated to separate Trumas and Maestras. And they actually said it quite openly. They say, Zochanu esadogosh anochal b'mitzayim chinam. We remember the fish that we ate in Mitzayim for free. And Chazal explained this. If it was mean chinam in our mitzvahs, there were no strings attached to that fish. And what it means is that they ate it without having to separate Trumas and Maestras. Because for that reason, right, they mention the kishuim, the cucumbers, and avitichim, the melons, because all these things are exempt from taking tumas and maestras outside the land of Israel, even on a rabbinic level. And in Eretz Yisrael, they're obligated on a rabbinic level to give them, because all of these are part of the Gan HaYarak, the beautiful, beautiful green garden of Eretz Yisrael, and they need to be irrigated, right, by a person's own effort, even in Eretz Yisrael, because they need a fortune of water. And the Pasuk actually says that. The Pasuk says, "Vishkisa v'raglacha," you have to mamish water it with your own efforts, k'gan hayarak, like a vegetable garden. So we see that a garden where these kind of things grow, it's obvious in any place that you need it needs to be irrigated by hard work, and therefore even there it's a show, they are actually exempt from the Torah, but the Rabbanon, the rabbis, obligated them in Trumas Maestras, because since there's so much water, it's not so hard, but not in Chutz Laretz, because there's not so much water there. And as we say, chinam in amitzvahs means that at that point they were a bit stingy, and they didn't want to have to support the kainim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore they hated Eretz Yisrael because of the obligation to give tzedakah. But the women of that generation, they were tremendously righteous women, and they loved giving tzedakah, right? Both the mitzvah, let's say, of challah, of separating tithes from the dough they made. They love doing that, which is a special mitzvah for women, and is dependent in Eretz Yisrael, and also all the other types of trumas and maestras. And therefore, they loved Eretz Yisrael, and they wanted to go to a place where they actually were forced to give these tithes, right? Because most women, right, has no control really over a husband's assets, and therefore they had a tremendous desire to go to these places where the obligation is incumbent on their husbands to actually give. And that's what it says. The Gemara says in Saita, in the merit of the righteous women who lived in that generation, Nigalo Avosenim Mitzrayim, our forefathers were redeemed from Mitzrayim. In other words, it's coming to say that in their merit, they were able to go from this place where they were exempt from giving tithes to a place where they were obligated to give tithes. Well, which the women had this yearning for, as we say in the Pasuk, Nichsafo v'gam kolso nashal, they were mamish, their hearts were going out, they wanted to go there. And that's why Chazal say in Baba Basra, that on Bunay Salafchad, that they were tremendously righteous women. And that's because they loved Tzedakah, and therefore they said, please give us a portion in Eretz Yisrael. The Kli Yakar continues, and he brings a beautiful proof of what he says. He says as follows, a clear raya of what I'm saying is, Harashi says, when it says, they came, who were they? They came from the Mishpachos Menashe ben Yosef, from the family of Menashe, who was the son of Yosef. Why does it mention Yosef? Because he also loved Eretz Yisrael, and therefore his daughters, he inculcated that in his daughters. And you know that these two tremendous attributes a Yosef had. One was that he was so careful in matters of immorality. He refused all the approaches of Mrs. Potiphar, and he was praised for it by his father Yaakov, right? But he held himself back from the wife of Potiphar. And the second reason, that he loved Eretz Yisrael because of the tzedakah. And therefore, Yosef loved tzedakah, right? And in fact, he went and supported the entire family of Yaakov. And therefore, his daughters inherited these two midas. And because of them, it says, they said, give us a portion in Eretz Yisrael. And it's a synopsis of his words. And maybe we can give one more brief reason why the women wanted so much to go to Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara says that, as explained by Rav Yonos and Eibeshitz, men, we know, have the ability to control their evil inclination by learning Torah. Torah is the property. Barasi Torah Yetzara. God says, I created a Torah, and I created Torah as an antidote to the Yetzara. So men can sit and learn Torah and rest control over the Yetzara. But the Gemara asks, women, the women are not obligated to learn Torah. How are they able to then sort of get control of the Yetzara? So Gemara says, by sending off their children to school to learn Torah and encouraging their husbands to go out and learn, that's their connection to Torah, and therefore they get the same ability to control the Yetzara. Now, in the desert, there were no distractions. There were no interruptions. Men could sit and learn Torah all day. Therefore, the women had no job to do. They didn't have to encourage their husbands. Husbands were doing it. Their kids were learning. So therefore, they had a problem. How were they going to get control of the Yetzer? And they knew in the land of Israel, there that men would be preoccupied. They'd have to work all the time. And then they would need to be pushed. They'd need to be encouraged to learn Torah. So they'd be able to do their job and get their reward of being able to control the Yetzer. Therefore, they wanted to go to the land of Israel. The men preferred the easy life, to sit and just learn, not have to work so hard in the land of Israel. And therefore, they were not desirous of going. Okay, will please God be back with our Hilchos Shabbos slot in a moment.
There are 39 milahot, which constitute forms of work forbidden on the Sabbath. It's the why behind the way we do the things we do. Join Rabbi Moshe Schnurb now for Hilchos Shabbos, only on 101.9 High FM.
What 101.9 Chai FM. This is Soul to Soul back on your radio. Erev Shabbos Kodesh. Parshas Pinchas Tov Shin Pei. Hey, as we prepare for another beautiful, beautiful winter Shabbos, already getting slightly longer the Shabbos, but it's going to be a beautiful, beautiful Shabbos. It's also, as we know, Shabbos Mevorchim this week. So before we get stuck into our Hilchos Shabbos, let's do as we always do at this time, just talk about the important details and times you need to know for this coming Shabbos. So this afternoon, the earliest time to bench licht is 4:28. 4:28, you can already get your Shabbos started. And of course, if we can, it's absolutely beautiful. Still plenty of time to do it. More than an hour and a half from now, get the food ready, get ourselves bathed and dressed, get the house all tidy and kind. When 4:28 comes, bench your licht and sit down and sort of heave a huge sigh of relief. The week is over. I've done everything I could do this week. Whatever I didn't do, we'll worry about next week. We're not going to worry about on Shabbos. And now we're just going to chill. We're just going to relax. We're just going to open a book. We're just going to talk to our children. We're just going to make the time significant, meaningful, and important in our lives. Because that's what Shabbos is all about. Creating the real relationships we need. Relationships with our family. Relationships with friends. And of course, most importantly, a real relationship with our Kodesh Baruch Hu. So 4:28 is the latest time you can bench. Sorry, is the earliest time. I'm getting confused. Is the earliest time to bench your licht today. The latest time is 5:17. 5:17 is the latest time to bench licht this afternoon. And that really means that is the final bell, sort of the deadline for our Shabbos preparations. By that time, everything needs to be done. Yes, of course, we have the 18 minutes that we know about between the sun, between the candle lighting time and sunset. But as I always say, that is explicitly meant for people who are, God forbid, in emergency situations and need that extra time to avoid, God forbid, breaking Shabbos. They can use that time, but it's not meant for us mere mortals. We have to have our Shabbos preparations done by 5:17. Therefore, it means that a sunset is then at 5:35. 5:35 is then the sunset, the absolute latest deadline for anything and anyone at that time. Shabbos absolutely has overtaken the entire universe, the spirit, the spirituality, the whole atmosphere of Shabbos fills everything, fills the whole entire world. Hopefully we are sensitive enough and we have the right antennas to be able to at least tune into it and feel a little bit of that Kedusha. So therefore, if you want to make sure you daven Kriyat Shema at the correct time, all you have to do is wait until 5:53. 5:53 is then night. And if you daven Kriyat Shema anytime after that time, that means you've made it, you've already fulfilled the Torah obligation of saying the full three Parshiyot of Kriyat Shema at night, and then we're free to come home and enjoy a beautiful, beautiful Shabbos repast. Still a little bit cool, not as cool as last week, but it's still pretty nice and cool. So you want to have a nice, good, warm chicken soup with some nice things in it and some good guests and some good family and have a beautiful, beautiful evening together. Again, it's still early, so please, once you finish the Suda, you don't need to go to bed yet. Sit and learn a bit. Sit and spend some time with your children. Go over, see what they're learning. Right? Help them. Inspire them. Tell them stories. Learn something with them. Make it a beautiful, beautiful, meaningful family time. Tomorrow, of course, we're going to Lain Parshas Pinchas. It's quite a long Parsha. Some very varied topics. Right? We read about Pinchas. We read about the counting of the Jewish nation. We read about Moshe Rabbeinu finding a successor. And of course, the whole last part of the Parsha from Chamishi on is about the special sacrifices that were brought on various special occasions, on all the holidays and Chagim of the year, specifically how many of this animal, how many of that, each one specific meaning and depth to it. The Haftarah is, of course, the first one of the 3 weeks of mourning that we read during this period, and it starts in the very, very beginning of the book of Yirmiyahu and goes to the second pasuk of the second perek of Yirmiyahu, and it sets the tone for the periods that we're going through. This week is also Shabbos Mevarchim. Rosh Chodesh is going to be next Shabbos, which will be the second Shabbos of the 3 weeks, is also going to be Rosh Chodesh Av. And therefore, although we will say Mevarchim Chodesh, we still will say Avarachim, as we do during the three weeks. And the day carries on. We start again the cycle of Pirkei Avot, beginning this week with Perek Aleph, the first chapter. We're going to do it another two cycles, Bezus Hashem. And it's such beautiful. It's so worthwhile. We're learning so many incredible, incredible, important lessons that we need to know in our lives. So Shabbos continues, as we say. And tomorrow night, Shabbos Kodesh is over at 6:09. 6:09, we've already sort of gained about 15 minutes from the earliest Shabbos. And we're on our way towards longer and longer Shabbos, which for some people is a blessing. And I know some people don't like so much, but we learn to cope with whatever it is that Hashem gives us. We are learning the laws of Mavir, of lighting a fire and or extinguishing a fire. And we're talking today about the laws that are specifically connected to the Shabbos candles. Now, while the candle is burning at home, one must be so careful not to open a window or a door that's sort of facing it, as the wind might even blow out the flame. Even if the wind outside is currently sort of too weak to put out a candle, one still may not open a window, since it might happen that at the very, very moment when the window is opened, the wind will suddenly become a gust, a much stronger wind, and blow out the candle. If this would happen, it would mean that the act of opening the window actually blew out the candle, right? And that would be sort of tantamount to that you blew out the candle, right? When there's no winds whatsoever, it's totally becalmed. There are some who allow opening the window, while there are others who still do not allow it because they're still worried. Okay, so now there's no wind. But what happens in 5 or 10, in 10 minutes? In a case of mamish necessity, such as when it's so hot inside the room, one may sort of follow the lenient opinion and the window may be opened. And that's the psak of the Mishnah Brura in Simon Reish Ayin Zion 277 Sif Gimel. Now, one may open a window or door if even a strong wind would be unable to extinguish the candle. Let's say, for example, the candle is at a great distance from the window or door, or if the window is at such an angle that very little wind actually comes through it. So even if the wind is likely to affect the flame and cause it maybe to flicker, as long as it is not powerful enough to blow it out, one may open the door or the window. And that's the Shulchan Aruch in Sif Aleph over there. If you lit Shabbos candles and you lit them in front of an open window and then the wind started blowing, the window may be closed in order to protect the flame. And by closing the window, one is not sort of acting directly on the flame. itself, when it's sort of merely preventing the wind from actually blowing it out. And that's the Ramah there in the beginning there of Reish Samach Zayin 277.
There are 39 milachot which constitute forms of work forbidden on the Sabbath. It's the why behind the way we do the things we do. Join Rabbi Moshe Schnurb now for Hilchos Shabbos, only on 101.9 Chai FM.
This is Soul to Soul, back on your radio. Erev Shabbos Kodesh, Parshas Pinchas, Tav Shin Pei Hey, as we prepare for another unbelievable, beautiful Shabbos Kodesh. You know, we are so privileged. So I think we sometimes don't actually fully appreciate the godless, the greatness of having once a week a Shabbos for us to sort of take our minds off everything, move away from all the rat race and all the stuff that's going on in the world, and actually place ourselves in a different realm, in a different world, in a different stratosphere even. We are in a completely different place on Shabbos. And I think sometimes if we fully appreciated that, we would get much, much more out of the Kiddush of Shabbos than we even do. We are talking about the halachas of being careful about one's candles to make sure that nothing happens, chas v'shalom, to actively be a sort of part of extinguishing them. So halacha is, one is actually allowed to close a door in a place where a fire is burning. Let's say you have a room, you have a lounge with an amazing, beautiful fireplace. So you're allowed to close the door, even if the wind coming in is blowing on the coals and fanning the flames. And closing the door will actually weaken the fire. Why? Closing the door in this case is not considered an act of extinguishing the fire, since it merely prevents more winds from entering and feeding the fire. That's what the Shulchan Aruch actually says in Simon Reish Ayin Zayin. However, in contrast, if the fire is fueled by a sort of gas or maybe even kerosene, then one may not turn down the flow of the fuel. This truly qualifies as mechabe, as extinguishing, since one is acting directly on the fuel itself. That you're not allowed to do. That will be considered that you are now diminishing the fire. And of course, diminishing a fire is basically the same as putting out a fire, and you're over that issa and that melacha. And of course, as we said before, lighting a fire and extinguishing a fire are two opposites of the same thing. And whatever would be an act of lighting a fire, if one makes the fire bigger in that way, so if one makes the fire smaller in that way, that's going to be the problem of mechabe, of extinguishing. So really, we're at the end of our tether, so to speak, at the end of allotted time together. It's time for all of us to sort of run off and scurry around and do the last minute things that need to be done for Shabbos and prepare ourselves for a beautiful Shabbos, for Shabbos Mevorachim, right? Shabbos Mevorachim Chodesh Av. Yes, it is Chodesh Av, but it's still Shabbos Mevorachim. Whatever's going on in your shul, grab it, be part of it, participate in it. Make this an amazing, amazing Shabbos in our lives. And I just want to thank each and every one of you for participating, for being part of the show, even if it's only for a few minutes. We really, really appreciate it. Any comments, please contact the station or myself. And we look forward, Be'ezus Hashem, to next week being able again to share some time together, some Torah together. And in the meantime, I want to wish every single one, every single member of our radio family a warm and beautiful Good Shabbos.